All right, let's keep financial planner Kevin McKinley busy this hour during an all questions answered edition of On Your Money. Good morning, I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Tuesday, April the 3rd. We promised last week to devote the whole hour of On Your Money today answering your questions as a thank you of sorts. Should we reach our goal in last week's pledge drive? Well, the goal for On Your Money was an incredible 300 pledges, but you did that and then a whole lot more. This is amazing. 482 pledges came in during On Your Money during the spring membership drive last week. Thank you so very, very much. And now, as promised, it's the whole hour devoted to your questions and your emails. So if you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. And you know what? We'll even answer a post on Facebook, the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Kevin McKinley, certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money LLC, with offices in Madison and Eau Claire, joins us from our studios in Eau Claire. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Joy.
How do you like that? 482 pledges.
I don't like it. I love it. Yes. And I am very humbled. It's interesting because it's both humbling and extraordinarily ego-boosting at the same time. So to those of you who were able to pledge last week, thank you so much. It's very appreciated, and it's a I love Wisconsin Public Radio. I don't get paid anything to do this show. I don't see any of the names of the people who are kind enough to donate this money. But seeing this come in, just the numbers of both the numbers of pledges and the dollars that those people do pledge allows me to contribute something to an organization that I care very much about, which is Wisconsin Public Radio. And hopefully it can help the network as well, and all of those people who did receive a copy of the On Your Money mini money book. Those who pledged at any level received a copy of this book during this membership drive. Hopefully that will provide some benefit and help to you as well.
Yeah, well, we appreciate your contribution too, Kevin. It's invaluable, and I'm happy that we are able to now devote this whole hour to all questions answered, and our lines are full, so you're going to be busy. Well, let's start with an email that we received from Sue and Pamela, and frankly, a lot of other listeners. The question is, how can I find a financial planner in my area to help me with my specific situation?
Yeah, that is very common. We sifted through the On Your Money email box, and this is one that comes up most often. We're going to be answering several other of the most frequently asked questions of us today, but this one came up more so than others. And the issue is not so much that I find anyone, it's I want to find the right person. And some people have a concern about paying for advice via commissions to people. Now, when you pay a person at the bank or the insurance company or an investment firm a commission to give you investment advice and hopefully put your money in the right place, that doesn't necessarily make it bad. It just means that there may be some incentive or disincentive that might misalign the person's investment recommendations with your goals. And so some people are more comfortable paying a fee for that advice and then going out and doing the investing on their own, kind of like they would pay a lawyer or a CPA. There are several different sites which allow you to search for a fee-based financial planner, CFP.net, NAPFA.org, and FPANet.org all have registered contact information for fee-based advisors. However, most of these people are going to be in larger communities, and even then, if you search through even the Wisconsin or Minnesota or Iowa or Illinois area, you won't find that many. And even when you do find one, it might not be the right person for you, and even if it is the right person, you can count on probably spending about $1,000 to $2,000 for their services to guide you through a whole financial plan, series of recommendations, and get you headed in the right direction.
Well, how much would we typically spend, do you think, for a financial planner?
Most people charge somewhere around $1,000 to $2,000. They usually charge it by the hour, and you should get an estimate of the cost in advance so you know what you're getting into and what you can expect for that fee.
Yeah, and what if maybe we don't want to spend quite that much money?
there probably are some opportunities you can use to get help online. LearnVest is a newer company that LearnVest.com, which offers you basically more of a virtual experience and some contact with a financial planner, but it's probably not going to be one you can meet face-to-face with. But that usually costs a few hundred dollars. And then many of the larger do-it-yourself investment firms like Schwab and Fidelity and Vanguard have kind of a more generic planning opportunity. Some people might be concerned that those companies would try to also sell you their own products as part of the financial plan. But my experience is they understand that that's a danger zone, and so they're reticent to push just their own products, but you're probably more likely to get their own funds. That doesn't mean their own funds are bad. It just means that you have to keep an eye out for that potential conflict of interest.
Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for everyone. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org if you have a question that you would like to pose to Kevin. And let's take our first caller, Eric in Black River. Hello, Eric.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
Very well. How are you?
I'm doing well. My question is this. My dad was trying to tell me that I should try to or explore the option of using an IRA to save for my daughter's college versus a 529 educational savings plan. Is that possible?
Well, it's possible, but like a lot of well-meaning parents' advice, it's about half right. What he probably was suggesting, or I hope he was suggesting, was that you use a Roth IRA for it. And the reason being, Eric, is that if you do qualify for the Roth IRA, and not everyone does, you have to have earned income. It has to be below a certain amount, but the amounts are fairly generous. And you can't borrow money to retire, but you can borrow money to pay for college. So if you have a young daughter, and how old is she?
She's one.
She's one. Okay. The advantages of using the Roth IRA is that if you need the money for retirement, then it'll be there. But if you have a retirement that's very well funded and it's not your biggest concern and you need to use it for college, then you can pull the money back out of the Roth IRA, the contribution portion, if you will, at any time with no taxes or penalties whatsoever, and use that for any purpose, including college. And that also can act as an ERSAT savings account for you, because as you put the contributions in, if something should come up, you can always pull those contributions back out and use them in an emergency. So if you do qualify for the Roth IRA, that usually makes better sense for your first dollar to go there. And then if you have money, extra money left over, then use the 529.
Okay, thank you.
All right, good luck. Thank you, Eric. Let's go now to Brian in Franklin. Hello, Brian.
Hello, thanks for taking my call. And I wanted to pay Kevin in the only way that I can and tell him that he's the best financial advisor out there.
Wonderful.
Merely stating a fact, Brian, doesn't do anything for me whatsoever. No, thank you, Brian. That you're incorrect, but it's still very kind of you.
I wanted to get your help in making a decision. My wife can now get our retirement funds in the TIA CREF group of funds, and they have fairly low, what do you call it, front-end load or something. Mm-hmm. I want to compare that to our financial advisor who's charging us the 1% fee.
Mm. So she is she's eligible to put money into the TIA CREF?
Yes, and also to switch our other money over to it.
Over to TIA CREF. Okay. The TIA CREF is certainly not bad. It's not the lowest cost provider out there. The much more prominent one is one like Vanguard, which I use and many people are very happy with. The question you have to ask, I like the fact that you are focusing on fees, on both what you're being charged by the advisor and also the mutual fund fees as well, because that's something you can control. Many people want to know that, you know, the stock market is going to go up or they're going to earn enough interest or whatever. We don't know what's going to happen in all these different variables over the coming day, much less the coming weeks, months, and years. So I do appreciate you focusing on expenses first, because that's a knowable quantity and it's something you can control to a great degree. that the IRF is okay. As to the advisor, you have to look at what the advisor provides and say, is it worth it to me to pay this the money to this person? And if it is to you, it is. If it's not to you, it isn't. And you are lucky because you have other options besides just paying an advisor. You can do it on your own. And if you like what TIAA-CREF can do for you, or Vanguard or Schwab or Fidelity or any of these other firms, you can save the money that you've been paying to the advisor. But if you do value the one-on-one service that he or she is providing, then maybe the expense is worth it to you.
Okay, thanks for your help.
All right, thank you very much, Brian. Let's go now to Kelly in Appleton. Hello, Kelly.
Hi, how are you guys doing this morning?
Very good. What's
up, Kelly?
I have a weird question. Hi. Where I work, they offer a program called the TSP, and I've been putting into it for about 12 years. I had gone online, and they're now starting to offer a Roth in a few months. They'll be saying we can transfer all of our funds over to a Roth if we'd like, but they haven't put much on there for it. So my first question is, should I transfer what I have in there to the Roth, or should I keep it on the TSP side, which kind of diversifies it into all kinds of different things? And my other question is it wise to take a loan out against that? You're really borrowing your own money. I guess it's at 1.25%, it's 1.something% right now to take a loan and pay off a car loan that's at 9.9.
So how much is a car loan for, Kelly?
It's at 9.9% interest, and I owe just over $12,000.
$12,000, okay. Well, you could save yourself a significant amount of money on the car loan by pulling the loan out of your TSP and using that to pay it off. The disadvantages of using a workplace retirement plan loan is that, yes, you technically are paying yourself the interest. The bad news is that if you lose your job, typically you have to pay all of the money back at that time or suffer a monstrous penalty in taxes and fees on what you aren't able to pay. And, of course, that's the time when most people are least able to pay off any debts they have. So have you gone anywhere else to see if you can refinance this car loan, like a credit union or a local bank?
No, I haven't. I was thinking I might try to go to a local credit union, too, just so I didn't touch it. But my husband was saying it's only 1%. You're not going to get that anywhere else.
Yeah, there is an advantage, and he's right, but there are risks to that. And if it creates a hardship for if you lose your job, it's going to be an even bigger one when they clobber you with taxes and penalties if you should lose it. Back to your original question about the so I prefer you just do nothing, keep paying the 9.9%, because if you run into dire straits and you've paid off that loan, it's always difficult to go back in and get a loan against the car because you're in dire financial straits. But use the option of being able to borrow against the retirement plan as a kind of an extra safety net underneath you, too, so you can get money to not only pay for the loan payment to keep your car and be able to go look for another job, but also to pay for other household expenses. In terms of the Roth, I'd much rather have you and most other people save for retirement at work in a pre-tax plan, like a traditional 401k, 403b, and then save by yourself if you have more money in the Roth IRA, rather than using the plan's Roth option, use your Roth 40B, 403b or Roth 401k. And we'll be talking about that in a couple weeks. But otherwise, no, stick with the one that you have right now and keep the loan that you have. But I would recommend you go out and look at another credit union or something, see if you can at least knock it down a few percentage points.
Kevin McKinley, certified financial planner, here to answer your questions on your money. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. This is an all questions answered edition of On Your Money. Kevin's way of saying thank you for your support during last week's pledge drive during On Your Money. We made our hourly goal and then some, so thank you very much. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Election Day in Wisconsin today. We will have updates on the results during our newscasts after the polls close tonight, so you can keep up to date on what's happening at the polls. We will talk about the election results tomorrow on the Ideas Network. Right now, it's On Your Money with financial planner Kevin McKinley, answering all of your personal finance questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. I don't know about you, Kevin, but I am looking forward to an end to the robocalls. Have you received maybe a thousand of those? Oops. Are you there, Kevin?
Oh, I am here.
You were answering a robocall.
I was answering a robocall. I was having a deep political discussion with the robo who was calling me. And I was winning, so I wanted to keep it going as long as I possibly could.
You know, in between the robocalls yesterday, not only was I hearing from, you know, politicians and their super PACs and other things, I got a call from Rachel from Financial Services. This is a scam call. I've been getting them for months now. Rachel from Financial Services has important information about my credit card. And so I'm supposed to, I think, call them and give them my credit card number.
Yes, make sure it is truly yours. And if you could actually send the card to us to verify that it is indeed the one that is on your record, we'd greatly appreciate that.
Yes, yeah, so that is one to hang up on for sure. I did get an email yesterday from a listener who said, please ask Kevin about a credit card. Well, she names it. I guess it's all right to name it. Called PenFed Visa Platinum Gas Rewards Card. That's a long one. PenFed Visa Platinum Gas Rewards
Card. Also known as the PFGVRBLTO card.
Anyway, she says, it sounds too good to be true. A 5% rebate on gas, no annual fee. It seems that I would need to make a one-time donation to one of their affiliated organizations. What do you think of this?
Unless one of the affiliated organizations is Wisconsin Public Radio, I would say probably not. And there is a catch to that, and this is something that people who are comfortable using credit cards or need to use credit cards should know, is that every credit card user has different needs and uses of the card. And there are lots of cards out there that are tailored specifically to those people, if you will. Creditcards.com is a really good website that has a credit card analyzer, so you can say, this is who I am, this is how much I charge, this is my credit score, what other types of cards out there. I think ExxonMobil has a credit card that actually gives you a rebate on gas, and there are several other fuel providers which also offer that type of card. It doesn't sound like something I've ever heard of, but it's not, I wouldn't say it's probably too good to be true. There are probably just extra fees on top of it that may cost her even more than the rebates she's getting on her gas purchases.
And that was Brenda. Thanks for that email, Brenda. Jane in Green Bay is with us now. Hi, Jane.
Hi. Thank you for your program, Kevin. My question is, with the loosey-goosey attitude that credit card companies have toward our personal information, and I've been thinking about doing this for a while, can you give me the website to institute a credit card freeze on my accounts?
Absolutely. You want to freeze your credit report, if you will?
Well, so that no one can apply in my name with a false address, for example, for a credit card.
Got it. And it's a very wise decision, because anyone who does have your Social Security number or birth date can not only apply for credit, but have, say, okay, well, this was my old address, send it to this new address. And in theory, it's possible for those people to get a card in your name. If that does happen, oftentimes people who are victimized by this are not liable for the charges by the other person. However, the charges tend to haunt people and keep echoing back for years, and getting calls from collection agencies saying, hey, way back when you charged this money on this account, we want you to pay us right now. And you have to prove a negative at that point. And you might be proving or trying to prove something to a party which is two or three times removed from the actual card issuer. So the best way to avoid that is to freeze your credit report. And the easiest way for Wisconsin residents to do that is to go to privacy.wi.gov. That's privacy.wi.gov, and we'll have a link up to that website at our website, onyourmoney.com. And what they have there is three pre-addressed letter templates that you can send to each one of the three major credit bureaus saying, I want to create an account with a password that basically locks this down to any new companies trying to get information on my credit history. And now it does cost $10 to freeze it at each bureau, and it costs $10 to open it again if someone wants to actually get a legitimate access to your information, and then $10 to freeze it again. But that's a little bit of a hassle and a very low cost. And it's still the best way to make sure that somebody else doesn't get access to your information. So privacy.wi.gov. You can contact all of the bureaus individually, but this is an easier way for you to get their information and have a letter that's already pre-written. You just have to delete Dear Sir, Madam, put your own name and information in there.
Thank you, Jane, for the call, and good luck to you. Andrew in Madison is with us now. Hello, Andrew.
Hi, Dre. Hi, Kevin.
Hi.
Hello.
So my question is, as a young person who is actually employed, thankfully, I'm starting to save some money, and I'm wondering if you have some kind of basic advice as to how to start investing money. Maybe threshold for savings when you want to start investment accounts, and kind of some advice for starting to get into it. Forgive me for being a bit disillusioned over the past couple of years here. Seems like investing is maybe not the best way to go, but I imagine there's a lot more safer areas that you can enter.
There absolutely are. It's a very good point. And you are to be forgiven for being disillusioned. It means you're paying attention.
Rachel at Financial Services, I hope that was a good idea.
Great idea, Andrew. Yeah.
I would love to get a call later on in the hour from Rachel in Financial Services, just so she can tell her side of the story here. A couple things I would have you do. First one is pay your debt off as slowly as possible, as long as it's not credit card, high-interest credit card debt, and as long as you're not going to spend the money. The second thing is any younger person who has a job should use an at-work pre-tax plan to save as much as they possibly can. Typically, saving $10,000 a year from the age of 22 to 32 will give you much more money in retirement than saving $10,000 a year from 32 to 65, if all of the things are equal. But what happens, and sadly I'm becoming aware of this, as you reach middle age, because you're used to living on less over all that time, because you've been deferring so much money into your retirement, your needs get less, you become less likely to develop a high expense lifestyle, which is actually the key to becoming financially independent. The less money you spend, the less money it takes for you to become financially independent, and really the more freedom you have. And it's easier to cut your spending by saving money into that pre-tax plan. And so save till it hurts into a 401k or 403b. If you don't have one at work, use an IRA or a Roth IRA if you think you're going to need the money at some time in the future.
Okay. All right, great. Sounds good. Thanks.
Thank you, Andrew. Thanks a lot for the call. Well, and congratulations for working and wanting to start investing. We have also an email, Kevin, from Karen in Milwaukee, who's on the other end of the employment scope. She says, are you saying it's best to take Social Security at 62? I thought it was better to wait until 66.
It typically is better. You get more money per month the longer that you wait. Normal retirement age right now is 66 for those born after 1943 and 67 for those born after 1960. And the dollar amount you get keeps rising every single year until you turn 70. And then after that point, waiting gives you no extra larger check. Plus, if you are 62 but not quite normal retirement age, any earnings you have from working while you are collecting Social Security can ding the amount of benefits that you receive at the time. But you do eventually get those benefits back down the road. What I really like about delaying, though, is it gives you more time to strategize. You can move money from IRAs to Roth IRAs and hopefully live off savings without having to pay a great deal of taxes on it. And then once you do initiate Social Security down the road, you're less likely to pay taxes on it because Roth IRA distributions do not make Social Security taxable.
But overall, you still say it's usually better to take it sooner rather than later?
That's right. One more year, waiting one more year to take the payment, if you will, guarantees that you are one more year closer to death. Mm-hmm. And you still have to live to be at least 78 or longer to make waiting an advantage for you. In other words, you have to live past 78 to make waiting break even. Also, if you're drawing from savings while you're delaying Social Security, it creates a great deal of risk because if some emergency should come up, like a medical emergency or a family member needs help, or it can be a good emergency, it can be something you want to purchase, retirement home, whatever, it's very difficult to draw from your savings or to get an accelerated Social Security check, obviously, if you've drawn your savings down to virtually nothing. But the real big issue, and the reason that I say it's usually better for people to wait, is because this is a very volatile time, as Andrew just mentioned in a previous caller. And when people are moving from working and saving to retiring and spending, that alone is very stressful. If you are delaying taking Social Security and then watching your savings erode either through the stock market or some kind of investment problem, that can be mind-wracking as you're trying to make this transition. So typically having that Social Security check starting to come in is more comforting to people because it's a more apt replacement to the paycheck that they've given up when they retired. And it allows them to not only ride out tough times better, but it also allows you to keep your savings intact for a future emergency, or maybe the stock market goes down and prices are cheaper, or interest rates go up and you can buy a CD at, say, 3 or 4% sometime in the future.
Kevin McKinley, Certified Financial Planner, Managing Member of McKinley Money, LLC, here with us during this special post-pledge drive edition of On Your Money, because you helped surpass our pledge goal during last week's show. Kevin promised to devote the entire hour to answering your personal finance questions. And we are getting a lot of questions on air. We have one open line right now, though, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Our next caller is John in Burlington. Hello, John.
Good morning.
Morning.
I just had a follow-up to the statement about using the Roth IRA for the kids' college fund. So that's, you're saying I withdraw out of my, Roth as a parent that I can withdraw for educational purposes for my kids.
You can actually pull the contribution portion out of a Roth IRA.
Okay.
And use the money for any reason. It's only when you get all the way through the contributions that you've put in and then start hitting the earnings, and the good people at the IRS let us designate all the first withdrawals from a Roth IRA as contributions until we've used that dollar amount up. And then if you pull money out and it represents the earnings portion, money that's been made on those contributions, that's when you are subject to taxes and or penalties. So if you put $5,000 into a Roth IRA for 10 years, you've put in $50,000. Let's say it's grown to $60,000. Well, you can pull the $50,000 back out at that time and pay no taxes or penalties and use it for anything, whether it's college or a trip or an emergency, what have you.
Okay, John.
So then is this, I know there's these college financial planning experts that kind of claim to hold the kingdom as far as your expected financial or family contribution.
Sure.
Is this what they're kind of talking about when they, you know, they hint that they have a secret that I don't know? Is this the kind of the avenue so it doesn't affect your expected family contribution?
Well, and it can actually it can hurt your expected family contribution, because sometimes retirement plan distributions show up as income, which then raises up your expected family contribution in some cases and at some schools. But no, typically the good ones who do that, and there are a few of them, but the good ones who do that say, here's how you should take your situation, shift your assets so that you may qualify for more financial aid, both things you can do before the kid goes to school and afterwards. And oftentimes, you know, do it without a great disruption to your financial life. Generally, for most students, there aren't a ton of strategies that can represent a dramatic saving. There's no such thing as free money out there that nobody knows about except these so-called experts. Sometimes people use the umbrella of college financial planning as an excuse to sell people cash value life insurance, because they contend that the money in the life insurance is sheltered from garnishment from the expected family contribution. That could be true, and cash value life insurance can be a good idea, but you shouldn't put money into it just to, you know, avoid paying for college. Most financial aid that goes to most kids comes in the form of loans that need to be repaid, not grants or scholarships. And so if you're okay taking loans out for school, and I am, it is what it is, and you can get subsidized loans in regardless of your financial situation in most cases. So I would tell people that, yeah, you should definitely pursue that, but don't spend thousands and thousands of dollars with someone thinking that they have some key to the kingdom.
Thanks, John, for the call. Stacy in Port Wing. Hello, Stacy.
Hello. How are you this morning?
Great. How are you?
Good. I have a 22-year-old college student who is going to graduate from undergraduate this year, and my husband's union has a great benefit where he gets $3,000 a year for a scholarship. He's been getting that throughout the time, but he has one more to get at the end of this school year when he graduates. We assumed he was going to be down and get a job, and we were going to help him pay his student loans with that last one, but now he's choosing to go to graduate school. So our question is, how do we help him plan with that $3,000? Do we pay towards the student loans he has? He has about $10,000 in loans now. Or do we invest it for him until he's done with graduate school?
Well, I like his attitude. It's the new American attitude put upon us by our leaders of just kicking the can down the road and really not ever, you know, taking, saying, all right, it's time to grow up and get a real job and go out in the workforce. And quite frankly, who can blame him? The way the employment situation of many 20-somethings, especially those who are just getting out of college, is not great. And so if he finds something that really will give him some benefit in grad school, good for him. The interest rate, I'm guessing, Stacey, is probably about maybe 6% or so on the money you've borrowed?
Yes.
Okay. So it's costing you $600 a year in interest. And were you to pay that, take that $3,000 and pay down that loan, it'll save you maybe $180 a year in interest, which is about $15 a month. If it were me, I would use it to just make sure you keep all the payments on the loans current and help him out with any other upcoming expenses rather than trying to retire that debt as quickly as possible. A lot of people are very afraid of student loans, and you should be cautious about taking money out for higher education with no real economic value. But typically, student loans can be paid off in 10 years if 1% of the original borrowed amount is made each and every month in the form of the payment. Even so, let's say someone has $30,000 in student loans when they're 22 and they graduate from college. And that sounds like an extraordinary amount, but it's about the average of kids who have loans when they get out of college. Their monthly payment is going to be $300 for 10 years, and then they'll retire the loan. Now, $300 is a lot of money, but that's the size of some people's cable bills. And what I found is people who have those 10 years of $300 a month payments, it allows them some liquidity and some time to figure out what they're going to do. And it also kind of creates an ersatz savings habit, because they're used to $300 disappearing from their checking account every single month by the time they're 32. A lot of times people who reach that point and pay off their debt say, oh, hey, I have $300 now. Now I'm going to start using that to save for retirement. So I'm not a huge fan of just taking out debt blindly to pay for higher education. But I'm also not a huge fan of rapidly paying it down, especially when he's kind of in a flux situation in his life.
Right. Now, do you think we should take some of that money and help him pay the tuition to graduate school? Is that a good investment for it, or are we better off putting it
only as the last resort? Check all of your other loan, grant, scholarship options in the financial aid office first, and then if they say, look, there's no other money available to you, the only way he can go to get into school and keep going is if you come up with another several $1,000s, then that's when I would tap that $3,000.
Thanks very much, Stacey, for the call. Good luck to you and your son. This is On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine with Certified Financial Planner Kevin McKinley. If you have a question, personal finance question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Coming up tomorrow at this time, we'll get the inside scoop on what calories are, how they work, and why they're the source of health problems around the world, according to our guest, the author of Why Calories Count, From Science to Politics. That's tomorrow at this time. This is On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine with Certified Financial Planner Kevin McKinley. And with the new program changes that started yesterday, this program, On Your Money, and every 8 o'clock in the morning program that I host on the Ideas Network is repeated at 9 o'clock at night. So if you're listening at night, you can't call in. Does that make sense? Sort of like a parallel universe going on here.
I was going to say, I'm usually getting ready for bed at that time.
I know.
I wasn't told about this.
9 to 10 p.m., we will be rebroadcasting the 8 o'clock hour, our weekday 8 o'clock hour, including On Your Money. So tonight, On Your Money is rebroadcast, as it will be every Tuesday. I think that's fun. All right, so here is our next email. We have an email from a listener who says, apparently this listener forgot your name, Kevin. Every week, he says that the interest rate for I-bonds is about 3%, but the Treasury Direct website says that the fixed rate is 0% and the inflation rate is only 1.5%. 3% at this time. Will he explain where he is getting his information?
By the way, I don't mind people forget the name. That's very common. I do appreciate it if, like, that one caller from a year or two ago called in and said, hi, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, the dude says Roth IRAs are is one of my favorite callers we've
the
ever
dude.
Had for the dude. The dude abides. From the same place as the listener is where I'm getting my information, treasurydirect.gov, but it's very confusing. We're talking about Series I savings bonds, and they do pay a 3.06% annualized rate, and it's adjusted every single May and November. So May 1st, a new rate comes out on the bonds, both new issue bonds and current bonds as well.
Why is there this confusion then?
It's because of the way the rate is calculated. Part of the rate is a fixed component, and part is tied to the Consumer Price Index. The I in Series I savings bonds is ostensibly for inflation. If you buy new bonds right now, the fixed rate that stays with the bond for its entire life, up to 30 years, is zero. But then there's an inflation kind of frosting on the cake, which goes up and down every single 6 months. The CPI inflation rate currently gives the yield through May 1st at 1.53% or 6 months, or times two, is a 3.06% annualized yield.
So in theory, how low could that rate go?
If both the fixed rate that goes with the bond and the CPI rate is zero, it can go to zero, but no lower than that. And even then, if you say, I have these bonds and I'm getting nothing from them, I see better options out there, I'm going to pull the money out. You generally don't want to pull a bond out that you've had for less than 12 months. But after 12 months, there's only a three-month penalty of interest if you pull that bond out and do something else with it. And after 5 years, there's no penalty whatsoever to pulling that out. The other nice thing about these is the bonds, they not only pay 3.06% right now, but that interest is exempt from state taxes. So for many Wisconsin residents, that's about like getting 3.5%. The bad news is that you can only purchase $10,000 per person per year of these bonds, and you can only get them online at treasurydirect.gov. But again, we'll have a link up to that website at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
And back to the phones we go. David in Rice Lake is with us next. Hello, David.
Good morning. Thank you for everything that you folks do. It's greatly appreciated.
Well, thanks for calling.
My question for you is that I've had bad luck in the stock market over the years and was wondering, is there a reason that I shouldn't just go out and buy some gold each month and invest that way and have, you know, some gold in the bank?
There are several reasons to not do that. There are some reasons to do it. The reasons not to are that it's a very illiquid investment. One of the nice things about a bond mutual fund or a stock mutual fund is that you know what the value is at any given moment or for sure by the end of trading every single day. And typically that's when you can get your money out as well. With gold, it's more difficult to find out exactly what the value is, and it's more difficult if the more liquid the actual investment is, meaning, you know, let's say you buy like a mutual fund that invests in gold. You're not really sure what that actually covers. There's always a question of what does that piece of paper you have representing your shares in the mutual fund actually represent. So if you say, well, I want gold just so I can hold it and hang on to it, makes me feel good, that's fine, except the more tangible the gold investment is, the more expensive it is to take out of the system and put it in a safe deposit box, and the more expensive it is to get back into the system and then sell it. And gold can fluctuate wildly in price, much like stocks or bonds. You know, the price has been as low as a few hundred dollars an ounce over the last several years and up to almost $2,000 an ounce. It could go to $4,000 an ounce. It could go back down to $200 an ounce. So if you're looking for shelter from the storm, if you will, a CD, those savings bonds we just talked about, David, and bank accounts are probably going to be better for you than something like gold or the stock market. Do you work right now, David?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Do you have a retirement plan at work?
No.
Okay.
Just my own.
Just your own. I'd recommend you look at an IRA and look at it one, you know, maybe at the bank or credit union if you don't like volatility, because at least by putting money in the IRA, you do get a tax break on the deposit. And for several people, you know, a $1,000 deposit into a tax deductible IRA saves them $200 to $300 in income taxes in the year of deposit. And that's a much better return on your money. It's more immediate. Yes, you might pay taxes on it at some point down the road, but most people are in a lower tax bracket in retirement than they are while they're working. So if you said, I want to get a better rate of return, but I don't like a lot of risk, I'd rather have you increase your return by reducing your taxes with a tax-deductible IRA deposit.
All right. Good luck to you, David. Thank you very much for calling. Now, Dan in Schulzburg is with us. Good morning, Dan.
Yes. Earlier you were discussing identity theft, and my question is, are companies like such as LifeLock and other credit monitoring agencies, are they legitimate or are they just giving you a false sense of security? Because I've heard comments going both ways.
I think it's both. I think they're legitimate. It's not like they're stealing money generally from people by charging you a fee to not only, you know, supposedly monitor your credit report and freeze your credit report. But they're also giving what I consider to be a false sense of security to some people, in the sense that even the founder of LifeLock, one of their advertising campaigns was he would very heavily promote his own social security number to say, look, I'm so confident in our service that I'm giving you my social security number. I dare you to try to steal my identity theft. Well, you know, with 2 billion people in the world with a computer and an internet connection, it doesn't take too much to bait them into trying to do that. So they did, and several people actually got his social security number, opened up credit for it. So they kind of clamped down on that as an advertising campaign. I don't know if it's a false sense of security. It might be just a sense of security. And the question is it worth it? Those services typically cost somewhere between $20 to $100 per month. And typically by freezing your own credit report, you do a lot of what those services can do. Admit it, and you can put fraud alerts on your credit report if you want to say, to tell the credit bureaus that if someone does try to get this in and it seems suspicious, I'd like to know about it. And it's much less expensive and you're in much more control of the information by doing it yourself, by freezing it rather than going through one of these services. But like a lot of insurance, if it feels good to have it, it may be worth it to you.
Sir?
Yes. Go ahead, Dan.
Yes. The issue with the freezing the report, for instance, if I try to get a government job that requires, say, like a security clearance, and they have to check my credit to verify, because a lot of corporations and government agencies will do that, would I have to then unfreeze it before they can see it?
Well, I know a little bit about this because I am a CIA agent, generally.
And we checked your credit report before, you know.
Before getting on Wisconsin Public Radio, that's right.
No, we didn't, by the way.
We really? Good. Well, that explains a lot. The issue with that is that, yes, you do have to open your credit report to have them look at it usually. If you do have that, though, you know, you're spending $10 to have them open it up and $10 to freeze it again after they look at it. That's a $20 investment for a job. And that's a relatively small price to pay to give them access to it. And any companies with whom you already have a relationship, like let's say you have a Citibank credit card, they can go around the block. So you don't need to open it up for them and close it for them every time they're trying to check your credit to see if, you know, you're paying your bills on time. It's just new people who are trying to get credit in your name. So in my mind, that's still worth the hassle. But, you know, if it's not for a future employer, it's your choice.
Good luck to you, Dan. Thanks for calling. Helen in Big Bend. Hello, Helen.
Hello, Kevin. Enjoy. You're wonderful.
Well, you're so kind.
Thank you, Helen.
You'll get a good answer now.
Yeah. Listen, the husband's been retired for 10 years but went back to work this year and has earned income. He's 73 and getting his recommended minimum distribution. Wife does not work, 69. Can they put money into a deductible IRA for her with his money? She's not employed.
Okay. Is the person who's working making a lot of money, or is it part-time income?
Well, it's enough to fund the IRA
okay.
to the maximum $6,000.
Okay, then my preference would be to just do the Roth IRA, because you're probably not going to be taxed very heavily on that earned income if you don't deduct it, correct?
Well, we kind of wanted to deduct it so we didn't have to pay so much taxes.
Okay, I get that.
And our IRAs usually lose money, so I thought we could convert it to a Roth later.
Here we go. IRAs in and of themselves do not lose money. IRAs are a jar, if you will,
right,
in which you can put any kind of investment, like stocks or bonds or stock or bond mutual funds or CDs, pretty much any kind of piece of paper. So the IRA itself doesn't lose the money. It's the investment contained within. And because Roth IRAs are also the same kind of jar with a little different tax status,
right,
you can also lose money on that as well. So you're saying the Roth IRA that you might get like at a bank or a credit union wouldn't lose the money?
I haven't looked into it. I'm just really wondering if they can do that, if we can put money into either one even.
You can do the Roth IRA. You can't do the tax-deductible IRA.
Cannot.
If you're over 70 and a half and taking the RMD.
But she did not.
The spousal IRA, I believe... I believe the spousal IRA, if I recall correctly, can be done as long as that person is under the age of 70. But I'd have to check on that to make sure.
Yes.
If you go to publication 590, Helen, at irs.gov, and if you get the one online, it's easier to search, obviously, than getting the pre-printed publication. So go to that and check to make sure. And if I can find the link that tells you exactly that, I'll put it up at onyourmoney.com later on today.
There we go, Helen. Thank you very much. Darren in La Crosse is with us now. Hi, Darren. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. It sounds like a pretty popular question today is how to fund college education for your kids. My situation is, unfortunately, we haven't necessarily put money aside, and we do have a son in high school now. And so being a little bit behind the game, I'm wondering, is there anything that we could do to fund it pre-tax or put some money away pre-tax for the next several years while he's going to college?
Probably not, or at least there's not something that makes sense. You're in a phase, Darren, first of all, people poorer and dumber than you have somehow managed to pay for their kids to get through college. So don't feel like this is an impossible task. And typically the way people pay for college is not by having $100,000 saved up the minute their kid gets through high school. It's by having a little bit of savings and having some income that you can pay as you go. You know, you've got, for 4 years of college, it's 48 months that you can pay per month. And then also either getting out loans for yourself or loans for the student. And when you add all those together, plus some earnings of the kid maybe, that covers it. And so rather than look upon this as a six-figure check you need to have ready in hand, I would have you say, well, what can we do and what should we do? Do you have a home? Do you own your home, Darren?
Yes, we do.
Okay.
And we do have some money in savings, so it's not like we haven't necessarily been saving, but not specific for college.
Okay. Yeah, you can use a 529 plan to both save for college and get a little bit of a state tax income deduction if you use the EDVES plan for Wisconsin residents. But it's a nifty little deduction, but it's not something that's life-changing. You only get to deduct on your state income taxes deposits up to $3,000 per year. So for many people, that means about $100 less in income taxes. I'd prefer that you look more towards liquidity and keeping that money set aside. Don't pay your mortgage off any faster than you have to. And in fact, if you haven't already, you may want to get a home equity line of credit to give you an extra safety net underneath.
Darren, thank you. Thanks to everyone who called today. Thanks to everyone who pledged to support On Your Money during our pledge drive last week. Kevin, thank you so much. And I understand you're taking a week off the show, and we'll talk to you again in a couple of weeks.
That's right. We'll be back to answer more questions.
Four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley, certified financial planner, and he'll be back in 2 weeks for On Your Money.